Tonight on Arena, Marianne Faithfull tells us of her love of Keats, Shelley, Byron and the Romantic poets, and Rachel Donoghue on her new novel, The Beauty of Impossible Things. If you were listening to our album reviews on Friday last, you'll know that Marianne Faithfull has a new album out, She Walks in Beauty. Inspired by her love of the Romantic poets, Byron, Keats, Wordsworth and Shelley, the album is Marianne reciting the poems backed by a musical soundscape created by Warren Ellis. Delighted to say that the 60s icon, singer, songwriter, actor and one-time Irish resident, Marianne Faithfull, is speaking to us this evening. Marianne, I'm not at all surprised that you've taken on the Romantic poets, Byron, Keats.
Oh, I'm so glad you saw that. Yeah.
They've been in your work, you know, I suppose forever and a day, really. They've been really important to you all along.
Oh, yeah. I mean, since I got into my teens, at 12, 13, I started to discover. I got a lovely book from my dad called Palgrave's Golden Treasury, and I recommend it. And it's just poems, all different poems from all different times. And it was in that book that I found The Bridge of Sighs, which is one of my favourites on this record, and one of Warren Ellis's favourites.
How did the collaboration work with yourself and Warren, Marianne? Was it a matter of, did you work together? Did you work separately, given that the times we're living in?
You know, I was, by the time we got to it, and this is before COVID, I was in London. I'd left Paris. I miss it terribly. But I'd left Paris and come back to London, really because of my son and my grandchildren. I really wanted, it's something I never expected, a family, you know. But my God, I have one. And they love me and I love them. So I came back and... Now I've forgotten the question.
I was asking you about yourself and Warren Ellis. How did the collaboration work?
Warren lives in Paris. And that was where I really got close to Warren. We sort of fell in love in a way, you know. Not all the way, but sort of. I really admire his work. And he really admires mine.
And my understanding is that you recorded the poems and then sent them, or at least some of them,
to
Warren.
That's right, yes. I recorded them in London in my flat and with Head, my producer and engineer, and then Head mixed them down a bit and sent them to Warren. But we didn't do all of them. We did maybe six or seven. And then COVID came. We recorded them before COVID. And then COVID came, and then I got COVID, and I was so ill, I nearly died. And then, thank God, I didn't die. I'm not quite ready for that yet. And then we had to finish it, and that was quite hard. I think you can hear it in my voice.
Well, look, you don't sound as if you're going to go out and run a marathon today, but, you know.
I'm okay, yeah. I'm getting better.
Yeah.
Slowly, gently, and with wonderful friends and a lot of love around.
Well, what I want to do, Marianne, I particularly want to listen to Ozymandias in full.
Ah, yes.
This is one of my favourite poems.
Oh, good.
What was it about this poem that it was a certain choice for you?
Well, the line I really love is his sneer of cold command. You know what I mean?
Yes, and when you think of a line like his sneer of cold command, this is written by Shelley, obviously back in Romantic times, but it speaks as much to today as it does to hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, it's a brilliant poem.
Let's have a listen.
I met a traveller from an antique land, who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies.
Look on my works, ye mighty and despair.
And despair, yes. I know. And I love that line, the lone and level sands stretch far away. I love that.
When you're reading a poem like that, Marianne, you know, and again, it amazes me that you did those recitals, essentially, absolutely by yourself in the flat into your own microphone. And then yeah. Warren responded to that, because the two things seem so perfectly knitted together.
I know. I knew Warren was right for this, you know, and he was.
What direction did you give him?
Well, you know, he's a very great musician. I didn't give him much, but I did say, please, Warren, no synthesizers, which made his job much harder. He had to use real instrumentation, and he did. You know, this harp, organ, all so many instruments.
And what he does with it is truly astonishing.
You really know, brilliant.
Particularly the words of that poem, in the introduction to the piece, I referred to you as the 60s icon. But when you recite a poem like that, it would teach you, don't think you're going to be anything after being an
exactly.
icon.
Exactly. It all becomes so meaningless, doesn't it? 60s icon, my ass.
When you are reciting them, then I'm wondering about the relationship between the fact that we're talking about lyric poetry here, the relationship
right.
between reciting as you do on this album, and if you were singing, you know, singing one of your own songs or singing a lyric, what's the relationship there?
It's very different, you know, really. I don't know why. You know, one of the poems was some. Thing I actually did want to sing. It's the one, it's also Lord Byron. So We'll Go No More A-Roving has got a very beautiful tune that Joan Baez recorded. And I wanted to do it like that. But actually, by the time we got to that lyric, I had been so ill and I couldn't sing. So I recited it.
So, yeah, I suppose fate has a funny way of dictating what happens.
Yeah.
You spoke, Marianne, about in some ways that this album has two aspects to it, the pre-COVID and the post-COVID. How frightening a time was it when you were in the midst of that COVID illness?
It was very frightening because I kind of realised I might die and I really didn't want to. I had to fight. You know, and I did, and I didn't die, thank God.
You'd fought with death before and won. Was this a very different experience?
Yeah, it was.
It was that consciousness, was it?
Well, I wasn't in a coma. I didn't really know. I do remember being in a very dark place. And I realise now that that was just before death. And I had to fight back. I don't think I did anything right. Honestly, I thank God I do.
Was it in any way that you talk about being close to death? Because you spoke about that before in the coma that you were in the 1960s and Brian Jones appearing to you and kind of beckoning you to come with him.
Oh, my God, yeah. That was pretty awful too. But a coma is quite different. You know, I wasn't conscious. I couldn't fight. I really had to just hope that I would get through. And I did. Thank God again.
And that aspect of being conscious while it was all happening, what were the things that you most wanted to get back to life for?
Oh, darling, I couldn't think that straight. It was really stripped down. It was just life. Give me life. That's all I knew. I wasn't thinking of pancakes and strawberry jam, you know.
You might have been thinking about family, though. You did mention your son, and that is a relationship that has gone through the mill and is in a very good place
now,
yeah, I think.
Oh, yeah, and still does, actually. We've had a very up and down time, but we kind of like each other, really, I think.
I guess most families have that aspect of, you know, ups and downs, don't they?
Yes, they do. It's not always easy.
The poems that you chose on for the particular, on the record here, we have 11 poems in total, Marianne.
Right.
Was there something specific about each one of them, or is it simply, I like these words, I like these sounds?
No, it was because they were my favourites, really. I just loved the ones I chose. I'm glad. I think I chose the right ones.
The Lady of Shalott, Tennyson poem that finishes the album. You gave yourself quite a task. I believe this was après COVID.
Après COVID, and it was a real risk because it's so long, you know.
It's 9-10 minutes, somewhere in that region.
12 actually.
12 minutes.
Yeah.
Sounds like you remember.
We did it. We managed it.
Sounds like you remember every one of them.
Yes, I do.
I want to finish up, Marianne, by going to the Byron poem that you mentioned. So we'll go no more a roving.
It is beautiful. Yeah.
And there is a sense in this. I hope there's nothing in your mind that thinks you're not going to go a roving anymore. You know.
Well, no, but I'm not. I've been pretty much struck down. I will get better, apparently, my doctor says. I don't smoke anymore. I don't drink or take drugs. I can't do anything like that. I really have to look after myself now. And I think I'll be all right. But, yeah, I won't, definitely won't be able to go a-roving, as it were.
But I did hear, I did see or read that you have plans. Yes, you still want to write. You have music to write. You have songs to write. And presumably that you want to perform.
Yeah, I do. I'm not giving up writing. Whether I can sing it or not, I don't know. We'll see. We'll all have to wait and see.
And the upcoming biopic with Lucy Boynton playing you, you must want to see that. You'll want to go out a-roving.
Well, no, I don't know. I want it to happen. I really think Lucy Boynton is perfect. She's the right actress. She's a really good actress. But whether they will all get it together or not, I don't know. It's nothing to do with me, you know.
Do you still, by the way, before I do go to, we'll go no more roving, do you still have a place here in Ireland? Do you get to visit often?
Oh, no, I don't. But I have so many, many wonderful friends. I just got a letter, you know, from my Frank McGuinness.
Ah, right.
He'd got the record and he was listening to it and he wrote me this wonderful letter telling me what he thought of it and he really likes it.
And of course, you had work with the poetry of Frank McGuinness's poetry previously. So there's a great, great working relationship there. Well, listen, Marianne, don't give up on the roving just yet for all of us. Promise me that at least.
I can't promise, but I'll try.
Give it a go. Lovely to speak with you this evening, Marianne.
Thanks, darling.
And let's finish up then with So We'll Go No More A Roving. From the new album from Marianne Faithfull, She Walks in Beauty.
So we'll go no more a-roving, so late into the night, though the heart be still as loving and the moon be still as bright. For the sword outwears its sheath, and the soul wears out the breast, and the heart must pause to breathe, and love itself have rest. Though the night was made for loving, and the day returns too soon, we will go no more a-roving by the light of the moon.
The indomitable Marianne Faithfull there with So We'll Go No More A-Roving, the Byron poem, music by Warren Ellis, and that from the new album, which we reviewed on last week's programme. The album is called She Walks in Beauty. We spoke to Rachel Donoghue last year on the occasion of the publication of her debut novel, The Temple House Vanishing. That novel was a story of teenage crushes and tragedy set in an Irish boarding school. Rachel's second novel, completed during the pandemic, is The Beauty of Impossible Things. The impossible things of the title are the visions and paranormal experiences of the narrator Natasha, a young girl living in a seaside town with her bohemian mother. And I'm delighted that Rachel Donoghue joins me this evening. I was just thinking, Rachel, it was March, I think March the 18th, that we broadcast the interview that we had with you just as the pandemic, as the lockdown was beginning to really kick in and we were stuck at home. So you didn't get to do any big tour with The Temple House Vanishing in a way that you might have planned and hoped for. Did that make the writing of the second novel easier, The Beauty of Impossible Things?
Hi, Sean. Yeah, you know, in a strange way it did. It was quite freeing in a way, because a lot of the attention had, you know, had gone, had moved on, and people were thinking about different things, and I wasn't promoting it really so much. So in some ways, it did kind of work, and gave me that kind of free space, which I think you need sometimes.
Had you already started on The Beauty of Impossible Things as the debut novel, The Temple House Vanishing, was out in the world?
I had started it. Not too long before Temple House came out, actually. So the idea was there and the voice was there and the setting was there. But the majority of the writing was done during the lockdown. And again, in a strange way, all that was going on probably to some extent fed into the mood when I was writing.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. that you feel that it did feel into the mood. Let's get a sense then of what that mood was and how you think it fed in. Natasha, as I said, is our narrator here, and we see her in two situations, really, as a woman in her mid-40s, I suppose, or thereabouts, mm-hmm. looking back on this teenage experience, this experience that she had as a 15-year-old girl. What was the importance of having the older woman look back in that fashion? Why was that important to you, Rachel?
I don't really explore what the trigger is for her to be looking back. I kind of leave that open. But in terms of, I suppose it's a summer that she's trying to come to terms with all these years later, and the significance of it, and the sort of part of herself that she showed that summer, she has hidden away really ever since, because it didn't prove to be a good thing to tell people what she knew or who she was. So in that sense, she's I like to think she's trying to come to terms with that now. But there's a lot of, I suppose, regret and wonder, and looking back, could she have done something differently? Should she have behaved differently?
Yeah, it certainly was. Yeah. It was an eventful summer for her, to say the very least.
Yeah.
And the title of the book, The Beauty of Impossible Things, explain what these impossible things are, because that's very much what sets the story into motion, that early part of the story.
Yes, in the June of the summer, one evening, Natasha sees some strange kind of lights hovering over the town, and she witnesses them on her own. She, I suppose, believes them to be a sign of something quite doom-laden or dangerous is going to be coming. She has this sense that it's a dangerous time and something bad will happen. So that's, I suppose, essentially the impossible things are these sort of unknowable strange occurrences that she has witnessed.
But the difficult thing, I think, for Natasha in many ways, is that she sees difficult things, or these lights seem to be a kind of a premonition around very difficult experiences that might happen to other characters in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not clear to her what it means, really. And I think part of the journey that summer is her trying to understand what this unknowable force is, or that she feels. She doesn't necessarily interpret it completely correctly, but she does have this sort of very strong empathic feel for people when she meets them and what they're thinking and what might happen. And that feeds in as well in terms of her sense that this is a sort of doom-laden time.
Well, a teenager seeing bright lights and having doom-laden thoughts around it. Doom-laden thoughts in teenagers are never too far away, one could argue. But for you, Rachel Donoghue, to write about this character and these these lights and the paranormal, the possible possibility of a paranormal aspect to them. What is your own attitude to that side of life or paranormal life?
Well, I certainly believed Natasha as I was writing. I suppose I was dipping into a little bit of sense of the setting by the sea and the notion of, folklore and, certain strange occurrences that people become stories in a town in a way, and also come to define a place sometimes, you know, if there's something that happens there that people remember. So I do believe in that. I do believe in the sort of the strength of those stories and how they travel through time and how people kind of share them and what they mean and interpret them differently. But I left, for me, the lights are kind of the unknowable. You know, they are the sense that there's something more that you can't quite explain. And I think she believes in that. And as I was writing it, I certainly understood where she was coming from on that.
Yeah, so you weren't going to make a judgment on her, if you like, as the author. You weren't going to judge that character. But boy, did the rest of the town judge her in terms of her beliefs and thoughts.
Absolutely. It becomes a kind of place of paranoia and strangeness, and also entrepreneurial activity. You know, people start setting up burger van joints and, you know, selling alien heads and various things. So that was kind of fun to write. But also it, you know, and as I say, in terms of just the feeling of people being afraid, I do think that's interesting in how they behave and, you know, how they also will seek to blame somebody. There needs to be an other. There needs to be, when people are uncertain, how they look to scapegoat somebody, or
To what extent? I mean, we're somewhere. You're not totally specific in terms of what year we're in, but there is talk of a very hot summer. There is talk of red sand. I have a vague memory of sand being all over cars some summer in the 1980s. I was also wondering to what extent the moving statue stories, which were not too far away from that period in time either, do you think that fed into the telling of this story in any way?
Possibly a little bit. It's certainly not consciously, but these things are always, you know, they're there, you know, again, stories you remember or have heard, or and the notion of a place becoming defined by something strange, I think that is interesting. And the red sand, funnily enough, and I've written a piece for the Irish Times tomorrow, but I have a memory of being in a kind of a very hot London summer, and then getting up one morning and there being red sand and it feeling like really strange, and what was this? So all these things play into the kind of mix, you know.
Yeah, because my memory of that time too is that there were all sorts of worries of, you know, might this red sand be some kind of germ warfare or something like that be going on?
Yeah, post-Chernobyl as well, I have a feeling maybe. So there's the elements of that. And I think I have a line, you know, it was a strange summer even before it became tragic,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and it does become tragic.
Yeah.
The other aspect, you talk about Natasha being othered, you know, there is this almost this idea that, oh, this young one who can see things and who can pray, you know, has premonitions about the future, that there's a witch element to the way that she is. Similarly, her mother is othered in the town as well. Maybe tell us a little bit about her and how she fits into the story.
Yeah, her mother is Elizabeth, and she's quite a young mother. She would have had Natasha probably about 18 or 19. She's a struggling artist from a kind of good family, but fallen on hard times, I suppose, in that sense. They have a nice old house that they live in, but there's not a lot of money. Her mother tries to paint, but never really finishes anything. She's very beautiful as well, which is, Natasha talks about it being one of the sort of central defining features of both their lives, was her beauty and how it drew attention to them, and not necessarily in a good way in that sense, her being under a gaze. I wanted to kind of, I suppose, explore that notion. And she's quite aloof, she's quite distracted, and I think in a way Natasha understands her mother more than her mother understands her, in terms of Natasha has a greater awareness of the sort of hierarchies in the town and of how they're viewed. And that they themselves have kind of always been othered. There's a sort of alienation there, both by her mother's beauty, by being a single lone parent, and also this sense of them having been a family that maybe had money at one point but then have lost it all. There's a kind of failure sort of all around them. And the mother responds to this by, I suppose, withdrawing from life, really. Though that summer, because they take in guests to make some money, she meets a man, Mr. Bowen, their lodger, who comes in and that relationship develops and also sort of disturbs Natasha to some extent.
Yeah, and becomes very much part of the dynamic and the story. I don't want to go into, you know, the tragic elements of it because I think that they come in the reading of it, although there is a great sense of premonition the whole way through it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things we get, because we have that, you know, older Natasha looking back at what the younger Natasha summer, we do get that sense of regret and that sense of, I suppose, how important self-forgiveness is. It struck me as an important theme in the book. Was that something that was on your mind?
Yeah, I think so. And I think acceptance as well, you know, sort of accepting responsibility for maybe actions taken at an earlier time and trying to come to terms with that and to understand it and to forgive her mother, I think. I think there's an element of, you know, they very much love each other, but it is a kind of claustrophobic and very difficult relationship at times, and I think there was, you know, this buried kind of emotions there, and I think that's really what she's trying to work out, who was her mother and what happened between them. So I think that's a big part of it.
Natasha definitely would like to change some of the things that happened back in her teenage years and some of the things that she did on a particular night that had tragic consequences for some of the characters that we grow to love in some ways. It struck me that as the author, of course, you had the power to go back and change all of that if you wanted. You would have had to write a very different book. But was there any sense of you as an author kind of almost a kind of regret that you had to do things to certain characters along the way?
Well, it's so, I know, absolutely, you are kind of running the show in terms of writing it. But in some ways, but I have, when I write, I don't. I have a very clear sense of the beginning and I have a very clear sense of the ending. Mm. I know what's going to happen to everybody. I don't know why it's going to happen. I don't know how I get there. But from the minute I meet them, so to speak, on the page, I kind of know
where they're going or not going.
And there's a sort of fatalistic element. And I think it does, from a structural point of view, sometimes I think it helps to know, but I can't, I'm very poor at knowing how to plan out. It just comes, you know, but I know the end.
Yeah, you have to find the way from A to Z.
Exactly.
The letters in between are what you work out in the writing of the book, so there'll be no changing what Z is.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Tough luck for the characters on that one.
Yeah.
Lovely to speak with you again this evening, Rachel. Thanks for coming in and speaking to us.
Thank you so much, Sean.
That's Rachel Donoghue there, author of The Beauty of Impossible Things, which is published by Corvus. And so to our album reviews on this Friday evening. First up will be Rag and Bone Man, nom de plume of Rory Graham. 3 years on from his enormously successful debut, Human, he gives us an album called Life by Misadventure. Formed on Merseyside in 1996, The Coral released their self-titled debut album 19 years ago. Now album number 10 arrives. Concept themed album of sorts. It's called Coral Island. And finally, Fears, the musical moniker of Irish artist, musician and producer Constance Keane. Today she releases Iha, first album on the newly created Tool record label, women-led independent record label focused on working with and for underrepresented voices in music. Kate Brennan Harding, Simon Marr have been listening to all three albums. We're going to start with Rag and Bone Man. Life by Misadventure is the title of the new album. It opens with a track called Fireflies.
Don't let fear be a thorny side. Keep your eyes on the light and let everyone know that you're caught in life. Fireflies in the garden, and past the trees and the stones ever thrown. Walk the longest way home and let everyone know that you're caught in life. Fireflies in the garden, go where the sunlight meets the morn.
And that's Fireflies, opening track on Life by Misadventure, new album from Rag and Bone Man. Kate Brennan Hardigan and Simon Marr, as I said, are our reviewers on this Friday evening. Kate, I have to say that your notes came in all in capital letters. And boy, were you giving us capital letters shouting about Rag and Bone Man. But you feel bad about what you're saying.
I do. I'm sorry about the capitals. My computer broke. I meant to say that. But it is apt, though. I feel bad about what I'm saying to a certain degree, because I think that Rag and Bone Man, Rory Graham is his name, I think he's a great talent. And he's somebody that I've liked watching his star rise, because he worked really hard for it. He's come late to this stardom at age 36. But I am absolutely fed up of these kind of albums. I'm fed up of the mediocrity of the music industry churning out bland, oh, just, you know, ridiculous songs that sound exactly the same. You don't really know what you've heard. But funny enough, if you heard it once, you can start singing along to it, because we're just battered over the head, really, with this kind of music.
Well, so I think we get a sense of what Kate feels from that, Simon. I don't think. Did you feel beaten over the head or battered over the head? Yours were in nice, simple, straightforward sentence case with capital letters at the beginning of the sentence and lowercase letters elsewhere.
I think it's every time I listen to somebody like Rag and Bone Man, you kind of think missed opportunity, because he has an amazing voice and he's got such power and such range that so few people actually have. But it's interesting. So from his first album, from about halfway through Human onwards, it's almost as if the record company guys got at him and said, look, you got to do this. This is the only way you're going to be big in America. You know, you got to do a duet with Pink. You know, you got to bland it down a bit. And so much of the time, because every so often he lets himself free. And when he gets free, it's pretty good. But so much of the rest of the time, it really is just so... it's disappointing.
Has he been listening to a lot of Bruce Springsteen, would you think, Kate Brennan-Harding?
I don't think that it's him necessarily that's listening to Springsteen. I think it's taking... now, I'm a Springsteen fan, but he's taking the kind of, you know, the generic pop hit. And this album was recorded in Nashville. So he went over to Nashville with his record company, and he's trying to get back to... he was originally more into singing blues and soul, and obviously Human, which was massive for him back in 2017, one of the biggest selling records of the, I think, of the late noughties. He decided that he was going to go and record in Nashville, and it's been marketed that it's a return to his roots, but everyone knows at the moment that Nashville is churning out massive commercial pop. And from that, I feel that the DNA structures of Power Ballads, the DNA structure of Springsteen, and some of what George Ezra has done are all just flung at this. And again, it is bland. And I think that it is such a pity, because he does have talent.
All right.
And he's trying to say something, but he's not getting there.
Let's listen to a track called All You Ever Wanted. So maybe it's kind of George Ezra meets Bruce Springsteen in that track, All You Ever Wanted. I get the sense that a huge hit with Human, but maybe not with Life by Misadventure. Summary and stars from you, Simon.
Yeah, he says himself when he talks about the album, he says it's a lesson in restraint. And I think that's probably the thing. That's the key to it. Somebody, whether it's him or somebody else, maybe we're unfairly blaming the record company, have decided that this is the route that he wants to take. But as I say, it's just such a pity. So I think two and a half out of five.
A lesson in restraint, 15 songs. What are you saying, Kate?
I'm going to say 0.5 out of 5.
Oh, Kate.
It's just, I really, 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 it's the cynical marketing of it. It's everything that's wrong with current pop music. And I love pop music, and I just can't abide it.
All right. Spoken in true capital letters fashion, that's Kate Brennan-Harding. Just not happy with album number one. Hope you're happier with album numbers 2 and 3. Let's see whether you are or not. Fears is the stage name of singer-songwriter, producer and former drummer Constance Keane. Mental health issues are explored on this, her debut album, Iha, out today. Tell us a little bit about Constance Keane, first of all, also known as Fears, Kate.
She is a fascinating character. She has been a drummer in a band for quite a long time called Male. She set up a record company called Tool after the fabric that she actually makes a lot of her own costumes. And so she set up this record label. She has been working in the music industry for years. This album itself has been in the making for about 5 years. And today, obviously, is release day. Now, the thing with Constance is that she is absolutely living and experiencing this, her life, and she's just putting it into art and creating something that is incredibly immersive, that is incredibly cathartic, and is something like she's going and exploring her own mental health and wellness journey and road into recovery from times when things have been very tough for her. And I think that this album explores these themes in a way that a lot of artists have not dared to go. She's very much being herself, and it's very raw, and I am really, really enthralled by it.
All right, you mentioned Tool and the Fabric there, so let's go to a track on the album which is called Fabric, as in the track is called Fabric. Feel like I'm in struggle motion, one of the lyrics in that song, Fabric, from Fears and her debut album, Iha. She certainly lays herself bare and manages to put across very strong emotions in the song, Simon.
Absolutely she does, and I think Kate put her finger on it when she talked about it being raw. Listening to this album, you almost feel nosy because, you know, she is bearing all, telling you everything about her struggles, about her life over the course of the last 5 years, and letting you in. And because it's couched in such beautiful music as well, and she's, you know, that beautiful vocal that she has, there's still that feeling that it's like, okay, I'm in on this, but should I really be listening to it? There's almost that bit of I'm almost eavesdropping on somebody's life. But the stories that she's telling them so well. And to put the musical framework on it as well, to have them sound so good, that beautiful, sparse electronica that's used right the way through the album, it's great stuff.
Yeah, the sparseness coupled with the electronica aspect is very impressive, Kate.
It's incredibly impressive, especially as you consider that she recorded it mainly in different bedrooms and hospital rooms and then put it together afterwards. And the thing is, like, in it, you'll hear the sound of a wave just sort of comes in and it sort of snaps you out of the feeling. I found that I've been listening to this album for a few weeks, and I found that it, first of all, it immersed me in the feeling. And sometimes, I think I've spoken about this before, I get immersed in the feeling, what the feeling is making, what the music is making me feel, and I don't listen to the lyrics for a while. And I very much felt like I was in this bedroom experiencing a wave of emotions. And then I started listening to the lyrics and I realized that I was tapping into exactly what she was trying to create. Sonically, there's just these lovely, it's an album that's very much worth listening to in full on headphones. You know, a sound system will do it well, but it's actually an intimate experience.
Yeah, and in fact that the title Iha maybe gives you even a sense of the time you should be listening to it as well. It demands quietness around you, and the headphones will give you that. And Tonta, you mentioned wave there. Tonta, one of the tracks, track 8 in fact, obviously the Irish word for waves. There's also a track called Bridget just in front of that. What's involved there, Simon? I think it's her grandmother.
It is. It's lovely. It's just like, it's literally, it's 40 or 50 seconds or, you know, about a minute long. And it's called Bridget. And it's just a chat. And it's a chat between her sister and her granny, and it's at her grandfather's wake. And it's just such a lovely talk, because there's so much of the album is obviously about the struggles, and this, which is potentially, of course, a very, very sad and emotional story again, but there's just such lovely little bits in it where the granny is chatting away in such a happy and such a, like, an upbeat way. And there's a line in where the sister says, "Cheers, no tears," and they have a lemonade together, and it's brilliant.
Yeah. Let's have a listen to a track down towards the end of the album, a track called Blood. Taste there of a track called Blood, and that from debut album from an artist called Fears. The album is called Iha. I think you both, I don't know if enjoyed is quite the right word here, Kate, but you certainly were impressed by this. Tell us, give us your final summary and stars. Kate first.
Sure. Yeah, I am really, really impressed. And I'm so proud of an artist to be able to speak in the way that she has spoken about her recovery and her, you know, resilience. Mm. And the album is honest. It's so needed, I think, in this digital age to talk about this stuff. And I think I'm going to give it 4 out of 5.
4 out of 5 from you, Kip. What are you saying, Simon?
Yeah, I think that's very, very fair. This is not the sort of album you're going to have on while you're doing the hoovering. But when you when you sit down and you give it, it's only 34, 35 minutes. When you sit down and give it that time with your headphones on, you will absolutely love it. And it's definitely worthy of a good 4 out of 5.
Yeah, and then in comparison to the 15 songs, almost 60 minutes that we got in the previous album, this is 10 songs, 31 and a half minutes. Perfect length for an album. Thank you very much to Fierce for that. Merseyside Band then, our final album, Merseyside Band, The Coral celebrate 25 years together this year, 19 years since their debut, now number 10 in their discography, a double album called Coral Island, the first since a musical hiatus that began in 2016. Simon, tell us a little bit about The Coral, and when I hear double album and things like concept or theme, I sigh.
I think there's no harm in having a, well, they keep giving out when people call it a concept album, but a themed album, if there's something to sustain it all the way through, if it's a story and it's got a beginning, middle and an end. But The Coral, I've really liked The Coral since they were around first. I interviewed them in 2001, 2002 when Dreaming of You was around. And they were a band that kind of got lost then in that sort of mid-2000s, went on hiatus, returned, as you said, in 2016, but have returned when I think much more of an acceptance of what they are and where they stand, what they sound like, and also where they're from. And that's what leads into this album, because this album oozes that northwest of England seaside town, you know, seaside resort bit. And that's why it's divided into summer and autumn.
Yeah, and we get, Kate, we get several little vocal interludes, I suppose you could call them, almost like little poems, the first of them being Welcome to Coral Island. Was the story clear to you? Were you carried across the, what have we got, 24 tracks, I think, in total, but some of them very short, those little interludes, as I mentioned. Were you carried? Did the story carry you?
Oh my God, absolutely. I was so pleasantly surprised by this album. I was not expecting. I kind of have not bothered listening to The Coral for donkey's years, you know, and I'm so glad that I was so completely wrong. But yeah, the little, the grandfather, so Asin Skelly's grandfather, he basically is being taken on to evoke exactly, bring us straight into the world of Coral Island. And the very opening, he's like, come with me. And he's saying that there is no past or future. There is only now. And you can be any version of yourself. And these act like chapters. But also, for me, I just thought of the spine of a book. It's the glue that holds it all together. And I think that makes it kind of magic. I think his vocal is so beautiful as well. It's just this real English, you're coming with me to the seaside. It's really, you know, it's transient. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and I'm going to play a track from the second of the two albums, in fact, it being a double album, which quite upbeat and very uplifting at this time of a Friday evening.
Life will be fine if I never had to earn another dime. Making my mind up would be mindless to me, 'cause I'd be gay and carefree under my palm tree, a calico girl with me.
The Calico Girl from Coral Island's new double album from The Coral. I was kind of in two minds about playing that song, Kate, because there's a kind of a novelty aspect to it, which isn't fair to the album in some ways. But it does give that seaside feel that's all over the album.
I was totally going to say, I was like, oh, that's not going to do the album justice, even though the song is great. I mean, it's very Beatlesque, very kind of Lennon-esque. But the actual, like most of the songs, like I love both. So I'm quite calling it both sides of the double album. And yes, concept and themes and all that kind of make me go a bit funny too. But I love this because it's just going back to listening to the album in full. And like, there's so many amazing songs on it. There's one on the first, it's Mist on the River. And it's the first song I just prick my ears up. I was like, oh my God, this sounds like I'm listening to Crosby, Stills and Nash. And I'm suddenly traveling around the world listening to an album that I'm completely immersed in. And like, you know, that's the thing. It's that track you played is lovely, but it's not a full representation of, I think, the magic in this.
Well, do you know what? To be fair then, I'm going to give you a minute of Mist on the River and then I'm going to ask both of you for your stars. How's that? Rather than misrepresent the album. Wouldn't be fair.
When the sun hangs over the water like a ghost in the sky,
time. Well, these days they seem like heaven when it all falls away. I look at you and in my mind I will say,
lovely harmonies. But hey, Crosby, Stills and Nash might be looking for a few bob for that. Is it pure pastiche or is it better than that as you give me your stars, Simon Marr?
I think it is much, much better than that. I think they have that. They've got that idea of being able to tell a story. And being, even though it's 24 tracks, I think it's only 55 minutes long. Yeah. It's still a pretty short album, but they just do it so, so well. And I think that James Skelly's voice has matured, you know, so okay. well over the 25 years of the band. I think this is also four worthy.
Four worthy. Worthy of four stars. And what are you saying, Kate?
I'm actually saying 4.5 because I'm just being different, but I think it's brilliant. I really, really loved it. That's all I can say. I loved it.
I loved it. It's brilliant, says Kate Brennan Harding, 4.5 stars. And she said that in capital letters as well, as well as the other notes. And Simon Marr also speaking to us this evening about the three albums, Coral Island from The Coral, Life by Misadventure from Rag and Bone Man, and Iha from Fears. And that is our lot for this Friday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sheila Nivuil was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you Monday night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1.